from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. When he was just 7 years old, Christopher Ategeka lost both of his parents to the AIDS epidemic that was sweeping across his native Uganda. He was the eldest of five children, and suddenly he was in charge. He would rise at 4 each morning to wash clothes, gather firewood, milk cows. But somehow, he still found time for school and to dream. 2 decades later, we find Christopher Ategeka in the Bay Area, having earned a master's degree in mechanical engineering from Cal and running not one, but 2 nonprofits aimed at improving life in his native land. How did he get here from there? The Christopher Ategeka story, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson, in today for Michael Krasny. As a teenager in his native Uganda, Chris Ategeka was doing all he could to support himself and his 4 younger siblings. He'd been on his own since the age of 7 when both his parents died of AIDS. But he also longed for a future that went beyond the dusty fields where he worked. He was bright, did well in school, and then a local charity helped launch him on a new journey that would eventually take him from Uganda all the way to the Bay Area, where everything was new: microwave ovens, alarm clocks, opportunity. First, there was community college, then Cal, and then a master's degree in mechanical engineering. And yes, there are more several and thens after that. But that's why Chris Ategeka joins us now to tell his story as part of our first-person series where we profile the leaders, innovators, and unique individuals who are changing the Bay Area and the world beyond. Chris Ategeka, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you here this morning. Yours is quite a story, and I want to just begin by going back to that earliest of times. Have you tell us something about what Uganda was like as when you were a young child and AIDS was so prevalent? Because while it seems extraordinary to those of us who grew up in the privileged environment of the Bay Area that one could be alone in so many ways at the age of 7 without parents, it wasn't unusual, right? There are millions of children like you in Uganda.
Absolutely, absolutely. There is Uganda has at least 35 million people and lots and lots of orphans. And the reason is HIV has taken a lot of the population. Lots of people die when they're young. About 60% of the population is children under 15 years.
And so there are, as I understand it, nearly 3 million kids who are on their own in so many ways, many times children who are actually the heads of household, as you were.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, there's that saying, the famous saying that, you know, if life throws lemons at you, you know, you better learn how to make lemonade. You better be a fan. Otherwise, you know, that's as sweet as it's going to get. So
tell me what your life was like at the age of 7. Your father had died. Your mom, who you never had a chance to know much, had also passed away. There was one other striking figure in your life, and that was your grandmother. Tell us something about her.
Well, I feel like even I stand and sit here with you today because of that woman. She's just extraordinary. She's a deaf mute, never had any education, never. She has her own sign language that me and herself understand better. No one gets it more than we do. And we can communicate. So she's the person who sacrificed a lot in terms of things to do on the street. She sold hawking little peanuts on the street to make sure that I survive. And she has done an extraordinary work to make sure that I turn out to be the person I am today.
And not only did her son, your father, die of AIDS, all of her children died of AIDS. Is
Absolutely.
That right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
So you had a grandmother who was helpful, but still so much of your survival depended on you. No, it's 20 years ago now, but can you recall what you felt like when you got up in the morning, how you approached each day? Just tell us something about what that was like from the moment you woke up and what you had to do to get through that day.
It's a very foggy memory because when you're very little, and first of all, you don't know what you're missing until you see what's on the other side. So for us, if you know, it's very common for kids to go whole day without food and you only have one meal a day. It's very common for kids to walk many, many miles to school. And it's normal life. But when you get to a place like San Francisco and you're like, I walked that many miles? So, yeah, it's, you know, you wake up every day and you're thinking about what you're going to eat that day. And then if it needs to go weed the neighbor's garden or do some work for food or some money, you do that. And then you secure enough food for the week until you're ready to do more work after school in the weekend.
And were you also doing that work not only to support you, but you had to do that for your four younger siblings as well,
That's
right?
correct. That's correct.
How did you find time to go to school? If you were, I mean, because you were, you know, gathering firewood, and you're describe where you live first of all, and then we'll get to how you got to school.
Well, it's a little thatched house, and you wake up and you go out, try to gather as much as you can, and for the most part, I did skip a lot of classes. I tried really hard to, you know, get through school because I wanted to get through school. And, you know, you go in, sometimes you don't go, and that was life.
How far did you have to go to school?
The numbers are very foggy because in Uganda we don't have signs or posters that indicate, oh, you're 10 miles away or 5 miles away. So it's long distance. You would walk, you know, many hours in the morning. But, you know, as later we'll, you know, probably be talking about, I eventually got a bicycle and that changed my life.
Yeah, we want to get to the bicycle. So you are in a position as a boy, not yet even 10 years old, where you're trying to scrounge for food each day, trying to support help your siblings, trying to get to school when you can. And somebody notices you. Somebody says, you know, that young man, he's someone we should try to help. What happened? Who noticed you, and what did they then provide?
So my grandmother worked really, really hard to support me. And part of her job was to work at some neighbor's garden. And I would help her sometimes. And at one point, you know, that person who was the boss to my grandma paid for me to go to school because school is not free in Uganda. And then eventually he couldn't pay anymore. But, you know, time went on and I left that household and I ended up another house. But for him, he saw maybe that I had a little bit of potential. And when this opportunity struck, he came down looking for me and told me about it.
And what happened then, starting with the bicycle, which played a key role in being able to get you to school, right?
Well, his name is Ben. He came down to find me deep in the village where I was and told me about a program. This program is run by an American woman. She's from Hawaii, and she moved to Uganda and started this program about 18 years ago. And the program helps orphaned and other vulnerable children to go to school. So they provide you with school fees and basic needs, and then you go to school. So he told me about the program and directed me how to find it. And, you know, eventually I did. And right here I am.
And the bicycle was key because it allowed you to be able to get places instead of having to walk several hours to get to school. It gave you a gift in a way, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, like I said, this woman started supporting me to go to school. And part of the support, on top of school fees and other basic needs, was to get transportation because I was walking many, many miles. And, you know, she gave me a bicycle and life changed because the bike, instead of hours of walking, now it's minutes of riding. I can get home earlier. I can gather food. I can use it to fetch water. So it was a life changer.
And we'll come back to the story of the bicycle and what you're doing now about bicycles in Uganda in just a bit. But I want to jump ahead in your story because then something else happens. People who were involved in supporting that charity in Uganda played a more active role then in your life. And tell us something about them, about Michael and Martha Helms and what they did as far as bringing you to the Bay Area.
I mean, I can tell you right now, it's hard to find amazing people and warm-hearted people in the world than those two. They welcomed me in their home and they made me their son, and something I will, you know, forever be grateful for. But, you know, the way it played out is Michael and Martha are part of a church. It's called St. John's. It's in Oakland, in Montclair area. So St. John's Episcopal Church is the program where they send the support to Carol Adams through the church.
That's the charity in Uganda.
Yes, charity.
So it came from a church in Oakland.
In Oakland. And through them, they send the money to charity in Uganda, and that's how the money got to me.
And the Helms family in particular was interested in sponsoring you, bringing you here, and bringing you to their home. Describe what that was like, that plane ride, because you'd never been on a plane before when you left Uganda. Tell us that story.
I had never seen a plane. I've never been on one. So I come from my village heading to the airport.
You're maybe 17, 18?
Around 20, 21. But I get to the airport, and this is ginormous something. It looked like a huge building. And I, you know, get in just like everyone else, and they show me my seat, and there's so many gadgets and electronics and all that stuff. And I'm like, at that point, my mind is just going crazy. but I was very, very interested in, you know, I'm a curious individual. So I was like learning and looking on what other people are doing with everything else and trying to imitate and learn as I go.
And there was an interesting moment of imitation that happened when they pass out, as they do on those international flights, a warm towel.
Yeah. The lady, you know, very beautiful lady comes down the aisle and hands everyone a warm, steamy towel. And for me, I had never received one of these, and I have no idea what to do with it. And they look around. I see people like wiping their hands, wiping their faces, and I was like, okay, that's what they do. So I decided to do the same. But I had come from deep in the village where it's like dirt roads with so my face was like dirt brown. I didn't notice that part. So I wiped my face with that little towel, and it turns dirt brown. And I got so embarrassed. Instead of giving it back, I decided to keep it.
And you still have it, right?
I still have it, yeah.
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 And when you arrived in Oakland, what did you think? What did you see? Because if an airplane was new, I mean, 880 must have looked pretty striking too.
That's exactly what I asked my parents. You know,
when you say your parents, the Helms.
The Helms are now my parents. They call me their son. When I got to San Francisco, they only had like a T-shirt on. I had never, you know, it was December. It was pretty cold, a little chilly.
Good thing you weren't flying into Boston.
I know, not New York. But they were waiting for me on the gate with a sign saying Christopher, and I had a shirt saying Uganda on it so that they don't miss me. I doubt they would have missed me in any way. And my sister Hillary was there too. What do you do? What do you say? These people have changed your life drastically.
And had you studied, Chris, English at that point? Where were you in terms of just being able to communicate?
English is a Uganda is a British colony, so English is taught in schools, but it's not great. So it's just like any other second language. People just take it in. So, yeah, I had a little bit of English, but at the same time, what helped a lot was, excuse me, when I graduated from high school, there's a gap year. I decided to work at Carol Adams, the nonprofit that supported me. So I decided to volunteer there. And there's lots of foreigners, Americans and British and people from all over the world that are working there. And the only mode of communication is English. So that helped me a little.
Do you remember, Chris, those early nights at the Helms home in Oakland, being in a different kind of home, obviously no longer a thatched hut, no longer having to face some of what you once faced? Do you remember feeling what you felt like when you looked out and saw the lights of the city, when you saw the alarm clock next to your bed or whatever it was, not having had electricity before? What was that like?
It's the same feeling I feel even right now. It's an ongoing feeling. My life has been a roller coaster in many ways, but I always pinch myself and just, is this a joke? Is this a dream? Is this a really, really long dream? I haven't woken up yet. So it's shocking, like little zaps of shock you keep getting. Like right now I'm sitting next to you, you know, it's those things that I just look at myself and look back those years, and never in a million years I would have ever thought that I would be here.
In fact, speaking of alarm clocks, you had an experience once early on when the alarm went off, right?
Yeah. So I didn't know that houses had alarms. And my parents had turned on the alarm in the house. So I wake up. I was jet lagged, pretty jet lagged. Uganda is 11 hours ahead. So I wake up and I see outside the city is beautiful because it's up in Oakland Hills. So you could see the bay and all the lights. And that was pretty new to me. So I decided I wanted to open the door and, you know, take a walk outside and check out the lights. And as soon as I touched the door, the whole system went off, like screaming and loud. So I was shocked. I was scared. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know what I did wrong. I wish I didn't open the door. I didn't know what they were going to do at that point. Maybe they're going to send me home. I'm that such a bad kid. But, you know, they woke up and they cut it off and they laughed it off and, you know, life went on. But I remember being pretty shocked.
And life did go on, and in quite remarkable ways. She went to Laney Community College in Oakland, and then on to UC Berkeley, where you studied mechanical engineering. And I want to go back to a moment to what you said about your plane ride, because you said you were instantly fascinated and curious about the plane and about how it worked. And is that what carried you into mechanical engineering, a desire to sort of figure out how things worked and how you could build things that might someday be products that could be helpful in your native land?
I can take it a little back. The way CARO's program worked, the nonprofit that supported me in Uganda, is when you finish high school, they support you to learn a trade, because most of the time they don't have enough finances to send some kids to college. But at that point, I was really interested in doing mechanical engineering, because not mechanical engineering, but car mechanic, which is kind of different. I wanted to work on cars. So I'm always curious. I'm always wanting to learn. So getting on a plane, I was very fascinated. We flew from Dubai to San Francisco, for instance, for 15 hours without touching the ground. And in my mind, I'm like, where is the food coming from? Is there like God dropping food on a plane? It's those little things. And I keep getting fascinated and fascinated. And yeah, as a matter of fact, when I got here in Oakland, I asked my parents to help me get into flying school. So I've done flying. So
you're a pilot now.
Yeah, I can fly, but I haven't got my license yet.
So. So you studied at Berkeley, got your master's in mechanical engineering, still working on a doctorate. And this brings us back to the bicycle and your desire to start a nonprofit that would make bikes, and pick up the story from there, what it is that you're doing with your organization that is now bringing bicycles back to people in Uganda.
Yeah. So when I talk about an ambulance, if I said that word to you or to any American, the first thing that would come to mind was, you know, is probably those sirens and big trucks and you know, those big guys coming to save you. That's not a common scene in Africa. There's a huge problem with emergency systems. And a little thing like a bicycle can mean life or death for some people. in America, a bicycle is it's a lifestyle choice. You get to choose to ride a bike. Yeah. But over there,
it's a life choice.
And not every Tom and John can have a bicycle. So it's a chosen few who can have bicycles. When I did my mechanical engineering schooling, combined with my experiences, I was in the middle of trying to figure out how can I use technology and my engineering knowledge and combine it with my experiences to come up with a solution that can help people where I come from. I'm in a very interesting position, I'm like a hybrid. You know, I understand the problem firsthand, but I also have the technical background to be able to do something about it. Well, growing up, I didn't have a whole lot of choice in terms of doing something about it as, you know, just watch on.
So how does it work? And we're going to take a break in just a brief moment. So just give us a little bit of it, and then we'll pick up on the story after our break. But your program basically not only is providing bikes now to people in Uganda, but building them, right? You're using recycled materials, scrap metal, and the rest to build the bicycles.
Yep. I started the program such that local people can use local resources, local labor, and build products that save lives. And to be honest, local people understand their problems better. You know, most of the time you see people bringing resources and money and just handing it over and leaving and hoping that they are going to solve the problems.
And how many bikes and bike ambulances have now been built in Uganda because of your program?
We've built over 1,000 products. That includes bicycles, wheelchairs, and bike ambulances. Hmm. And it's in many different places.
We'll find out more about Chris Ategeka's story, about the bicycle program, and the other things that he's doing. It's not the only nonprofit he's involved in. He's doing something else involving AIDS. We'll find out about that and the rest of his story when we return. 866-733-6786 is our number. If you have a question for Chris, join us at 866-733-6786. More of his story and more of our program after this. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum. Tomorrow morning on Forum, we'll bring you special shows from our archives for Thanksgiving Day, including interviews with the hosts of the Discovery Channel's Mythbusters about their favorite explosions. Food writer Michael Pollan on Cooking with the Family, and Saudi Arabia's first female director about her country's restrictions on women and the movie she was only allowed to direct with a walkie-talkie from inside a van. It's all tomorrow morning on Thanksgiving Day. And you can always listen to past shows by visiting kqed.org/forum. Thank you. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson, in today for Michael Krasny. Our guest today is Chris Adegeka, who grew up in Uganda. His parents both died of AIDS when he was the age of 7. He wound up, through a remarkable series of both his own talent and initiative and the help of others, being able to come to this country, where he has now received a master's degree in mechanical engineering, working on his doctorate at the University of California, Berkeley, and has started a nonprofit, which we were just getting into before our break, that is providing bicycles to people in Uganda. And as Chris was saying, bicycles provide more than just a lifestyle choice. They sometimes provide life itself by forming a kind of ambulance that can get people to medical services when they're most in need. We'd love to get your thoughts on Chris's story and your questions to him. 866-733-6786 is the number. We'll take calls in just a moment. But on the bicycles, you lost a sibling because they couldn't get to the hospital in time, right? Is that part of what drove you to want to make not just any bicycle, but bicycles that could be used to sort of get people in need to the help that they were in need of?
Absolutely, absolutely. And to this day, I still feel like he would potentially be alive if there was some means to get him to the hospital fast. Part of that, and, you know, it played a big role in getting me doing this.
So what supports the program, Chris? Because you distribute these bikes free of charge, right? So where does the money come from? How do you... Because to make this work, you not only have to have the knowledge of the problem, as you do, the knowledge of a solution and the ability to create this, as you do as a mechanical engineer, but you've got to be an entrepreneur as well. You have to figure out how to make this work as a business. How are you doing that?
Right, right. So the way we started, it was basically, lots of it has been a lot of generous support of individuals and organizations that have given us funds. And you know, it's never enough. The problem is so ginormous that, you know, whatever you have just doesn't compare with the problem. So we get funding. We've gotten funding from NGOs and individuals, and that's how we've been able to get this far. And just in order to kind of create a sustainable model, we've worked with other nonprofits, international and local, in Uganda to produce some of these products and sell them to the nonprofits and put a little margin, and that margin goes around into supporting the nonprofit.
It's called CA Bikes, and the CA has multiple meanings, right? Walk us through what that stands for.
Well, CA is you know, I'm in California. there's California. I went to Cal. My initials, Chris Adegeka. The lady who got me this far, her name is Carol Adams. So, you know, all combined, it just felt like the right thing.
Let's go to our first question. Sydney in San Rafael joins us. Sydney, go ahead.
Thank you. This is an inspirational, wonderful story that we're hearing, especially for Thanksgiving. And I am inspired listening to Chris's story and the story of his family, and as well as his pursuing his educational path at Cal. That's very impressive. You were just talking, Chris, about the organizations that help with funding. Could you possibly give your listeners a contact so that we may contribute as individuals?
Oh, thank you so much. I really appreciate you. So SiaBikes.org is our organization, and there is a donate button on the left side. And also, if you want to contact me directly, personally, there's an email on their website. You can send me an email and we can work it out.
CABikes.org.
CABikes.org.
All right. Sydney, thank you. Thanks for your interest and for being part of our program this morning. And while we're involved in the various efforts that you're engaged with, you've also decided that you want to try to do something about AIDS, which is such a scourge across much of Africa. 20% of Ugandan children have lost parents because of AIDS. What is it that you're trying to do in that arena?
So HIV/AIDS is one of those silent killers. 35 million people in the world have HIV known. And the word known is very key because the people who may not know are expected to be three times that. And my parents passed away because of HIV/AIDS, not because they, you know, should have passed away. But if they had a detection mechanism at the same time, had the resources, HIV is manageable just like any other disease. You just take a pill every day and you live a full life. So with my partner, Anwar, we started another company. It's a for-profit. It's called Prevail. And we build it looks like an at-home pregnancy test. So it's an HIV test that you can do yourself at home. So we'd build these units, and our hope is to get the company to the level where we can distribute these to millions and millions of people around the world.
And you shuttle back and forth between here and Uganda?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And, yeah. Those plane rides, any better now?
It doesn't get any better. It's just the distance and the time zone. So it's a long ride.
Let's go next to Paul in San Francisco. Paul, go ahead.
Hi. Interesting story. I have something maybe I could contribute. A friend of mine heard a rumor that there was no AIDS in Senegal, West Africa. So he traveled to Senegal, West Africa, and researched it. And what he found is indeed there was no AIDS in Senegal, West Africa. And the reason was is because Senegal sits on the largest deposit of selenium in the world. And so he wrote an article in it that was published in the Townsend Newsletter for Doctors back in 2000. Long article detailing that AIDS is totally preventable if people take selenium. But since there's no money in selling selenium, you can buy it in Walgreens. There no media in the United States will cover this story that selenium is totally.
Paul, I'm gonna hold you there. Paul, thank you. Thank you for the story. It's interesting, and I know other people are looking into this, but I just want to hold you there because I'm not sure of the connection that has to Chris's story in particular. But let me branch off of your comment, Paul, to ask you, to what extent now in Uganda and elsewhere, Chris, is AIDS a topic that can be discussed? Is it something where there is a lot of educational efforts going on, or is it something that's still sort of not possible to have the kind of educational conversation you need to so that people can get the medication they need much earlier on?
I mean, it's a very complex problem. It's a distribution problem, people having able to access the drugs. It's a diagnostics problem. There's a lot of stigma issues. So, you know, the person who's carrying on a test down the street at the hospital is your neighbor. And most of the time, once they know you're HIV positive, then the whole village knows. So that people don't want to test. That's why our solution, we really want to make it possible for people to test in the comfort of their own home and go on and carry on their own, try to find the help they need outside those little circles where the stigma could be a huge issue.
866-733-6786 is our number, 866-733-6786. If you have a question for Chris Ategeka, joining us this morning as part of our first-person interview series. Bobby Michelle joins us next in Sebastopol. Bobby.
Yes, hi. I'm very happy to speak with you, Chris. Chris, I have a question. My daughter currently lives in Uganda. She's a humanitarian worker working for an NGO. And she's recently run into or has met two young orphans. And we were wondering about the possibility of adopting them. And we were just wondering how you felt about that, you know, if there was anything that would make you consider not adopting in terms of taking children from their homeland. You know, they are truly orphans. They don't have parents. And I'd just like to get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, it's an interesting issue. Thank you for raising it. This came up a lot after the tragic earthquake in Haiti about whether it was appropriate or not to adopt children in that circumstance. Any thoughts, Chris?
My thought to that is, you know, to be honest, those kids have absolutely nothing. And the opportunities they get in the United States, you know, education system, the love, the care, all those kind of grooms them into the next human being that's going to go back and make a difference in that community. So I am totally for adoption. If you have the resources and the ability to do so, please do it, because 10 years from now or 15 years from now, you're going to look back and see this one kid that used to be helpless and useless in turning into someone helping millions of other people.
What do you say to those who say, but, you know, you're going to lose something of the culture that you grew up in? If you're adopted by a white family in the Oakland Hills, to use an example, that you don't wind up maintaining that connection to the culture with which you were raised, to the that part of who you are. Is it to you that that's trumped by, yeah, but if you don't have anything, then you having something is better than nothing?
I have two examples for that. One is if someone is in those circumstances, really dire need, they're going to die of, you know, the next disease that comes up or end up in jail or something. They're going to end up useless anyways. So is culture and all other I think education happens everywhere. If you are in the U.S., you have a different kind of education, and it's a personality thing. If you get up here in the U.S. and turn into an American and never go back to your country, but here, even in the U.S., if you think about it, your children want to get away from you. If they were raised in New York, they want to come to college in California. If they were raised in California, they want to go to New York. You know, it's not that of a drastic change for them, but it's a different environment. So change is always good.
And in a way, it's what's allowed, obviously, you to not only do what you do, but to make it possible for you to keep going back. I mean, you keep going back. You're back in Uganda half of the year.
Right? And now I can afford to do so.
Yeah. Judy in San Francisco is next. Judy, go ahead.
Yes, good morning. Chris, what a wonderful and inspiring story. I so appreciate it. I wanted to comment on your bicycles. There's an article on the front page of the Chronicle about the police warehouse where they're storing over 800 unclaimed stolen bicycles, and which looks like it's a problem. I don't know why. Perhaps you could use those bikes to give to children in your program. It looks like a good source for bicycles. I'm sure other cities have a stockpile of them as well.
Judy, thanks. Great idea.
So we have a program in on the UC Berkeley campus. It's called See a Bikes at Berkeley, which is a student club. And what they do, they recycle used bikes. And what they have a storage unit where they keep the bikes and sell them to incoming students. And the students who are graduating, they sell their bikes to the club, and the club kind of keeps recycling them within the system. So those bikes, absolutely. We could use them at the school at Berkeley, and the profit from that entity kind of venture goes to supporting SIA bikes.
I see. So those bikes, even if it wouldn't be practical to ship the bikes from the San Francisco police warehouse to Uganda, they could go back through this program at Berkeley,
yes,
be part of that, yes, resold, and some of the profits from that wind up supporting CA
Absolutely.
Bikes.
It doesn't make sense to send a bike from here to Uganda. It costs three times more. So it makes sense to try to translate that resource in terms of money, and that the money goes to supporting the program. And that's being done on the UC Berkeley campus.
I can tell the entrepreneurial part of you is has taken hold. A listener writes, how much does it cost for Chris's nonprofit to provide a bike or a bike ambulance? I think donating to CA Bikes on behalf of a loved one and being able to say to someone, you funded a bike ambulance, would be a great thing to do.
So a bicycle costs about $100, and a bike ambulance costs about $400. And each ambulance serves many, many people in villages. So if you put an ambulance in one village, the impact goes a long way.
So for $100, you could fund a bike ambulance in Uganda. And how often might that ambulance be used? How often would that provide life-saving assistance?
Oh, the ambulances are packed. They're used five times a week. And out of the five, we are talking about sometimes saying, you know, one or two of those situations, if they didn't have this service, it could have been deadly. So It serves a lot of people, and it's the fact that it's built local, it's durable, so it can be around for a long time. And if you know, and if someone donated and they wanted the name of their loved one to be honored on this ambulance, we could definitely write it on there, and we can do that.
866-733-6786 is our number. If you have a question, thought, or a source of bicycles for Chris Adegeka, you can join us at 866-733-6786. You got to give a graduation speech when you got your degree at Cal. I'm curious about what that experience was like for you and what it is that you wanted your fellow graduates to hear.
I wanted to tell my fellow graduates that anything in this world is possible with the right amount of passion and determination. You just got to keep trying, and many, many times doors are going to get slammed in your face. And what gets you through is not giving up when one door gets slammed in your face.
Do you sometimes find it hard for, when you're around your fellow students, or especially when you were an undergraduate perhaps, that there isn't as much awareness of what most of the rest of the world must contend with? Did you ever want to just grab a student by the shoulders and say, do you know how lucky you are? I'm just wondering.
It's one of those things. We all have a story. And we all have, and every day is a chapter in that book that everyone is writing in their life. Sometimes what may be too little for me, and it could be huge for the other person. In this country, there's a lot of things that are just handed, and they're there for you. And if it doesn't work, it's a huge problem, and it upsets you. I understand that part. But for me, coming from the background where I come from, whenever things hit me or don't go the way I want, I always tell myself it could be worse, and I move on.
Where does that come from?
It's in there. I've cried. I've cried many times, and I've had to stop. You can cry forever and you just stop. So things have happened. And then as a coping mechanism, you tell yourself, if this is the problem, what's the best thing I can take out of this? If anything, it just becomes a learning experience and you move on.
Do you know where that source of strength came from within you, Chris? Was it your grandmother? Was it something that just you think was a gift that you came with you as you came into life. Do you have any idea of where? I'm just fascinated by what allowed you to look at those circumstances and say, well, I'm just going to keep moving forward. I'm going to make the best out of this circumstance that I'm in.
It's hard to say where the source of where it came from. My grandmother definitely did a great job to love me and show me that, you know, you are a person. I see you, you know, I can see you. And that kind of got me to keep going from that angle. But, you know, moving on, you just have to get some of those things that come your way and make the best out of it.
Kathy in San Rafael has a question. Kathy, go ahead.
Hi, thank you. I'm curious to hear what happened to your siblings and where they are now. Have they had any of the opportunities that you've had?
Hi. Thank you. That's a great question. They've not been as lucky as I've been, but they've been way more lucky than they would have been if I didn't come here. So I have, with the help of my parents here in California, we've helped most of them get established in one way or the other. Like one of my sibling is an electrician, so he fixes electric issues in people's houses and he earns a living that way. My sister is going to college. My other sister has a store that he uses to support, she uses to support herself. So the whole point is to try to kind of get them independent and self-sustaining such that they can move on with their lives and don't have to worry too much.
Kathy, thanks for the call.
Okay, thank you.
Dewey writes in, so when are you going to write that book?
There's a lot more chapters to the book that I feel like they're in, need to be worked on. But someday, I would love to write a book. And part of that is, you know, finding the right resources, the right help. And I'm not a writer. I'm some, you know, nerd engineer kid from Berkeley. I can't write a book. With enough resources and help, I will potentially write one someday.
Where, as you look forward into whatever those next chapters might be, you strike me as someone who probably has another idea right now, that it's not that the bicycle thing is great, the home detection case for AIDS, wonderful, but I bet there's another idea bubbling around right now.
I mean, I'm very, very fascinated with global health. If you're not healthy, then the whole world is around you and the people around you is just, you know, in standstill. So I feel like in the U.S. there's insurance systems. I'm very rigorously researching right now on how we can provide a universal healthcare system for people at the bottom of the pyramid, potentially who can't afford to pay for
it. Would you just go fix the government website, by the way? Could you just take care of that for us?
Well, they can.
That's an engineering problem.
Make it happen. We can make it happen. But yeah, just trying to be able to go and support people at the bottom of the pyramid in any country, you know, it could be India, China, Mexico, Africa, anywhere, and support their health, and then everything else I think will start from there. And I think the reason the Western world has thrived is the idea that there exists the middle class. So if you support people's health in like the middle class, for instance, in the developing countries, the poor people can move into the middle class, and then the middle class work hard and the economy can be better, and then maybe potentially people will get out of poverty.
Would you ever want to go back to Uganda full-time, Chris, to take on this in every possible way, whether that's through, you know, government office? Where do you think you can do the most?
I think I can do the most without physically spending 100% of my time in Uganda. And that's for obvious reasons. And one is, you know, being able to have an opportunity like this to come and talk with you. The Western side, the Western world has lots of resources that can support the work that you do elsewhere. being a president of Uganda next year, I don't know about that. I'm not a politician. And I don't think that fixes the problem because part of the problem is the government systems. There is a lot of corruption. There is so being able to, I'm trying to work out ways how we can find innovative, creative ways to get around the bureaucracy and the corruption to get the bottom of the problem.
I'm wondering if you have any advice for people who are just finishing college now or perhaps are seniors at Cal, not sure about what they want to do, uncertain about their future. What you obviously are someone who figured out how to get from point A to point B and on and on and on. What would you tell that person to get to that next step?
I would say if you're still confused and trying to figure it out, it's okay. It's okay. Most of the time people tend to push it too much. They feel like they failed. They are losers. And, you know, your dad paid the tuition and they want you to get that job. And you're like, I don't have a job, you know. I'm looking for one, but I can't find one. So just not push it too much. But I can tell you one thing. Passion. Passion is the source of finding what you want to do with your life. If you wake up and there's, something that annoys you, it could be trash. It could be like anything that, you know, it's in your way. If you look at all the Fortune 500 companies, all the big companies, they are solving a personal problem. You know, you can look at YouTube, you can look at anything. Like, these companies are solving personal problems. So if anything annoys you, look at it. It's not a problem at that point. Think of the solution. And with the idea that you really want to do something about it, that creates the passion and that moves you to the next level of the next thing you will do.
Describe your passion.
Passion. Passion.
And what is yours?
My passion is entrepreneurship. Entrepreneurship. I want to be able to create that company that will reach millions and millions of people. And I will keep at it until someday it happens.
Chris Adegeka, best of luck in everything you do. I have a thought that you probably don't need much luck.
Oh, thank you.
It's a great story. We appreciate you being part of Forum this morning.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I appreciate you having me here.
Again, the organization is cabikes.org. There's a link to it on our website if you're interested in learning more. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi, along with Tina Lorberg. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our interns are Keelan Cronin, Nick Zabrowski, Victor Valle, Angela Johnston, and Aaron Newport. I'm Dave Iverson, in for Michael Krasny. We'll have a special holiday edition of our program tomorrow, including some of Michael's interviews from the past, everything from Michael Pollan to the hosts of Mythbusters. Those will be on our program tomorrow. We hope all of you have a lovely and joyous Thanksgiving and that a little bit of Chris Adegeka's passion inspires you over this holiday weekend to share that with others. I'm Dave Iverson. Happy Thanksgiving, everyone. This is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.